I'm Alexia Ridley with Athens News Matters, a show dedicated to local news, current events, and community outreach efforts. Today, panelists discuss pocket neighborhoods, the Athens Regional Library becoming a trauma library, and SPLOST 2020. Those topics and others next on Athens News Matters. Hello, I'm Alexia Ridley, host of Athens News Matters. My guests today are Lee Shearer from the Athens Banner-Herald and Gwen O'Looney from WXAG. And first up today, we're going to talk about pocket neighborhoods. And I know, Gwen, that's something that you found particularly interesting to bring up today.
You know, the master plan that was done, our community master plan that was done in the 90s during my tenure, it was a major focus was on building density for workforce housing and for downtown, you know, putting density where it belonged and protecting areas where we felt like that it was inappropriate. And one of the problems was we never put in place the technical and the specifications for developing these in-town neighborhoods, or even the kind of pocket neighborhoods that are possible in the outside the loop. We recently had that happen on Epps Bridge Road, right there at the Timothy Road intersection. That was rejected by our commission, and it's an example now of what they're looking at in the Sunset Clover, they're calling it, in the Normal Town neighborhood, of it's a major change, but it's a very small indication of what can happen. Instead of building building five large houses that fit the RS8 residential zone, they are only going to proposing seven that will be a RS3 or whatever. And this has got to happen. This has got to happen in Athens if we want to truly integrate our neighborhoods in a way that is design compatible with the surrounding areas and fits our density needs.
So what are you saying, Gwen? What is it actually looking like?
It looks like it's very similar to, you can see the pocket neighborhood that's on Lumpkin as you're coming out of Five Points going out. There's another very small sample of pocket neighborhoods that is off of King, where one driveway goes into four houses that face inside, very compatible to families with children, very buffered from the street by other homes.
So almost a little neighborhood,
right?
In a neighborhood.
Sharing green space, maybe closer together, but facing each other or into a green space. The other one is behind Normal Town, behind the old Allens, and that whole block is circled by houses that are built at a smaller density facing. All of those are planned developments that had to go through the commission, et cetera. You can facilitate that with good design guidelines and good space understandings, what the buffers need to be, what kind of neighborhood should be protected, et cetera. But we're once again behind. We have not taken the reins and done that. And I'm glad to see us thinking about it.
One criticism that rang true for me on the Epps Bridge development was that this was really targeted at wealthy people or relatively well-to-do people. It seems like some of these others that you've mentioned are or would be as well, which is going to lead to less diversity in the community.
You're right. The others that we have allowed are half a million over on Lumpkin, and probably in the 300 to 400, and that's the That is what is happening in the Sunset, Clover, and that normal town area. That is, 400,000 is becoming very normal over there. So this will allow much smaller houses to be built. It's a good example of where we can go to accommodate that workforce that we're talking about. But even when we say that, how many people who are, you know, we have got to be even more creative. I think we need to rehab a lot of the apartment complexes and make them where they're either condos or they're accommodating larger families in workforce. They're not just single, very small apartments are what our blighted apartments are. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. But this is one of the first that we've seen that actually is a middle income or lower upper, whatever. But it's definitely a small, they're less expensive homes than in the other examples I gave. You're correct.
And does this concept do anything to increase affordability, or can it? Or is that a whole other dimension? One thing seems to me is that it's just inevitable that as a community grows, land in toward the center goes up in value.
And That's correct. And we've got huge areas between Broad and Baxter, for instance, that really need revamping and development. The problem always comes if you don't control that, make it mixed income or create a formula that gives space to workforce housing, then you end up in a situation where it does just, gentrification in such a way that you really run people out. So it's a careful change that has to happen, but it's inevitable that those areas are going to go this way. So I think it's so important that we put in place the guidelines that can give us that density, that mixed income, that assurance that they're going to go toward in a way that serves our community and protects the surrounding neighborhoods from losing any of their privacy or feeling of residential
safety. Those guidelines are absent now?
Yes.
That's a nice, succinct answer. Yes. So we're going to move on to SPLOST 2020 or SPLOST 2020, however you prefer to say it. Where do we start on this, Lee?
Well, last night at the county commission meeting, the commission adopted program goals and project selection criteria. And one very interesting part of that was that they added equity to their criteria by which projects will be judged. Equity and subtext there, redress. We're talking about historically marginalized communities, elderly, disabled, people of color, and so forth. There, the Mayor Nancy Denson, also announced 21 of the 22 members of a Citizens Advisory Committee, which will help to screen these projects, which would be built, if voters approve, in November 2019, over a 10-year period.
Nine,
according to the documents. And what was that, $248
million?
$248. You can do a lot with that.
Not as much as you think.
It will be interesting to see how equity works out in this.
Right. I think this was an interesting support that was given to Mariah Parker. She took an initiative and presented a very well-worded amendment, and it became the commission's adoption. And I thought that was very good. It was interesting to me. There were two issues that came up, and there are always, of course, issues when you're talking about how to spend $250 million in your community. But one was the objection of Mr. Hamby, essentially initially introduced it, the $4 million in additional operating cost. But when you think about that over a 9-year period with only as projects were included, I thought that was, I disagreed with that. The other thing about that is that
other commissioners did too, really, because they pointed
yes,
out that
they did.
This is over the entire period.
The 9-year period,
and
right. It won't be until the conclusion when those projects are finished.
When the tax digest is likely to rise a good bit more than that.
Right, if they don't think it. Yes. But, you know, 3.4 is a mill. But the reality that it was interesting to me that the commission is looking at SPIOS as a way to subsidize our general fund. And I have objected to that consistently. I think we've moved into a position to where we're not looking at what we want to do in our community any other way but how to avoid raising our property tax.
How specifically do you see that that subsidy you're talking about? And what?
Well, look at the last two SPILOS. If you look at them, the amount that has gone to public utilities to do things that were
routine maintenance.
That's routine maintenance is amazing. And public utilities is supposed to be a franchise fund. It's supposed to be separate, a separate budget that raises its own monies. That's water. You know, the water department is supposed to raise its own money, but it has not. It has been dependent upon SPILOS for the last two SPILOS.
As opposed to public works.
Public works, my gosh, has been,
that's streets.
Right. We built, yes, and streets, for sure. I mean, we used to, when we looked at our budget each year, we put in there a maintenance cost related to our streets. We've reduced that consistently. As we've gone, we've become more and more dependent on SPILOS. I think of it like the community development block grant that we're now losing completely. But, you know, when we started that, we said we're not going to use this for short-term money for long-term needs. And we did not put our police and our other operations that were crucial, core operations, on there. We're putting more and more core operations. One of my greatest concerns consistently has been that we have not improved our recreational facilities except with SPILOS money. Only SPILOS money has been used for their maintenance, and that's a long period to plan for, is 9 years on maintenance, in this case 10 years, this SPILOS we're in. Leisure services is one of your most important infrastructures for economic development. Study after study has shown that, and we have neglected that. It is a department that has not grown, and our facilities have been maintained through external monies.
It may not be too strong a term to say that their budget has been starved over the years.
That's right. That's right. That's a good way of putting it, Lee. We've got, you know, I think, anyway, they're worried, you know, they've used T-SPLOS to subsidize the general fund there. And in all of those cases, what they're doing is they're taking the burden of facilities that we have in place and need maintenance and sustainability. They are taking that burden and transferring it from property tax, which is essentially property owners and corporations, to the public at large and visitors, 40%, I know, and I'm for that. I want to get their money, but I want to use it for special things.
I think you make a very valid point, but let's not forget that SPILOS built the Classic Center, that it built our library, and it built East Athens Park, many, many things that
yes.
really and truly enhanced our community.
That's right. And
there's a really good opportunity this time because some of the things, and we've said this before, that took up large parts of SPILOS before, like the
jail.
Enormous jail, aren't at the top of anyone's list this time. We're talking things like a park for the western part of the county and a library on the east side.
And there needs to be a library on the west side, too.
We're also talking about a big government building, but
right.
That's for another time to discuss.
Yeah, I agree with that one. And you're talking about the library. Tell us about the trauma project.
Trauma informed. The library has just gotten a 2-year nice grant from the federal government, working with the University of Georgia School of Social Work, to become a trauma informed library. And trauma informed is a concept that's been making some headway lately. And I think I'm correct in saying it's the idea that when people do bad things or are distressed, it's the result of trauma. And we're moving in our school system towards a more trauma-informed disciplinary system. But this grant has two aspects. I've talked to Valerie Bell and Donna Brumby over at the library today. One is to build a peer mentoring network for teenage girls. The other is to have UGA School of Social Work graduate students actually in the library and helping the library be the kind of community resource it is when people, how do I say this?
Would they act as a sort of counselor or someone advisor?
They would, I think, more advisor. They would connect people with the services or other kinds of help that might
kind of like
out
an
there.
In-person 211.
Yes.
For delicate issues.
For delicate issues. I asked, actually, why is this for girls and not boys? It's the boys who go to jail. And they told me, and I think they're right, that there's already a lot of that kind of resource out there for boys, less so for girls. And it's going to start pretty soon, too, in October.
I think it's another example of how aggressive our library has become in finding, seeking, and getting outside funding. We could not ask for a more progressive and aggressive approach to making the library a community center. This is so appropriate.
And our library director, Valerie Bell, thinks that the library is the heart of the community, which I think she's right, and she's making it even more so with this and other programs that right. The library's been installing. So she's working with middle school kids.
Yes. You know, one of the things about the library in my mind is that we really should be looking at putting not one library. We looked at a library in the current Spilas, and we decided against it because we had the $100 million jail, and we couldn't add it. And
it was
now,
only 60-something million.
Yeah, that's only because it came in way under budget. When it was in that budget, it was $100 million.
Yes.
But anyway, but I really think we are one library behind, and so we don't need just one library in this. We need to make a major statement in our community that libraries count and that they are an important part of our infrastructure. So I think and that was one of the things we didn't talk about the 2020 discussion in the commission was geographic equity. And I don't think that's an invalid point at all, but I do think that we do need a park, we need more parks, we need more libraries, we need those kinds of things.
Just a little context, Commissioners Andy Herod and Jerry Neesmith, while the commission was talking about the kinds of equity that exists, raised the concept of geographic equity, which in this instance means that people outside the loop, the more suburban areas of the county, have often felt shortchanged, not just in SPILAS, I think, projects, but in government services.
Right. Well, you know, it's very interesting to me because I think that there is a culture of people who do think that the county is not served as well. And if you look at it, they don't have solid
outside
waste
the loop,
services. Yeah, outside the loop. That we've maintained too much of some of the differences that we thought would erase, you know.
But doesn't that fit in with the whole density and green space? I mean, we've been trying to keep the density outside the loop down, more or less.
Right.
And that makes services outside the loop more expensive.
Or it makes them different. You know, we need to have a better understanding of what kind of services best support what we're looking for in these different areas. And you can only control so much, of course, but you can guide a whole bunch that we're not guiding right now. I wanted to say one more thing about SPILAS 2020. I think that we should be very careful in looking, for instance, the form that citizens will use in support and submitting their requests for SPILAS hasn't even been shared yet. And it's supposed to come out this week or sometime soon. But our staff has already projected, you know, a whole bunch of projects. And I think that we need to be in a situation where we're very careful that we evaluate those projects related to maintenance. For instance, the downtown master plan was not even included in the...
But it will be now.
It will be now. That was one of the changes that was made. And I think that, you know, you can say, well, that's downtown and that's another inequity. But the reality is that that downtown is used and enjoyed, I think, by people from all over our county. It's our living room. And that is, and it brings in a lot of money.
That's a great way to put it, Gwen, our living room.
Mm-hmm. It's where people socialize and where they stay, you know, in tune. And lots of tourists come for it, et cetera. So it feeds our communities, one of our community needs that I think is really important, just like Sandy Creek Park.
When you talk about generating income for the county, an awful lot is generated downtown. So it'd be interesting to know how much sales tax comes from downtown.
It's a huge amount. I mean, it's kind of hard to believe sometimes when I was first told the numbers, and I don't want to say them because I'll be wrong, you know, saying off the top of my head. And it's very specific. I mean, those people who are presenting those numbers to us are working really hard to make them specific so that if questions are asked, how was that figured, they can answer that conservatively. And at this point, we really are getting a lot of conservative. But the Convention and Visitors Bureau that we have here, along with the Classic Center, are recognized throughout the state as one of the highest producers and with the least cost to the county. We don't subsidize our Classic Center, our whatever, Civic Center, whatever you want to call it. We don't subsidize it. That's unheard of in our state. Atlanta and really our legislature, they completely fund the Georgia, the whole process.
World.
And it, yeah.
Lee, I know there's something else that you were interested in bringing up today, and that's the safety of our voting machines.
There was a speaker at last night's commission meeting who asked commission to go on record as showing some concern about the vulnerability of our voting machines to hacking. There are a lot of people who know about computers and hacking who think Georgia's machines are quite vulnerable to hacking and to having outcomes of elections manipulated. There's no proof that I know of that that's actually happened or not, but teenagers can hack into these machines. The commission decided not to take any action on that. They were saying that this is Secretary of State's call, which I don't think precludes them from saying something about it, even though they might not be able to do anything about changing the machines.
People want to have a paper trail or be able to have a record of how people voted if there were any questions that came up later.
That's right.
And our machines currently do not allow us to do that.
No, that's correct.
That's right. And, you know, when we chose this system, we were lauded throughout the nation for being one of the first that went to
not
this.
Not by everyone.
Not by everyone, but it was a big wow, Georgia is really being progressive. I mean, that's the way we were tooted.
It was tooted. The risk of being an early adopter.
That's right. The risk, and that's exactly what I was going to say, is, and I think that while I don't believe anybody has a question about our local Board of Elections and how well that's been operated and the integrity of our local people, I think the fact that the governor is governor's race includes the Secretary of State has made a lot of people look at this. When they're closing 7 precincts in a small county that only had 9,
They didn't do it.
But that was proposed, and that proposal came from a consultant that was supported by the Secretary of State.
He's fired, though.
Well, that was after he'd been all through the state. That's after the scandal.
After national news.
That's after
as well.
The scandal. But that's after it was in the Washington Post, and it was recognized throughout this state that that was wrong. It's only when he was found out that Brian Kemp fired him. And there are lots
of people. Was actually hired by the county.
Yeah, but he was Brian Kemp's friend that had been recommended to them from the Secretary of State's office.
But
that's been documented.
Kemp has also been criticized for just being a naysayer as far as the possibility of these machines being hacked.
And you know, but Kemp is also purged our rolls of 40,000 people. Being a person with an apostrophe in my name, let me tell you, we would have been thrown off if my husband had not put in Olani, where we don't have the apostrophe in our names. But if we had had our apostrophe in our names, we would have been one of those people that had been looked at for purging. And that's ridiculous because we vote every single time the polls are open. But that's an example.
I wish I knew. This is one of those things that I wish I knew what the difference is or the congruence of the possibility and what really happens. Because in this situation, our elections could be hacked and there's no way to know. I mean, it's not like somebody voting in the name of a dead person. You can find that out. That doesn't happen very often. That's a kind of voter fraud that's a concern to an entirely different group of people.
It's a myth, too. It happens very seldom.
Largely a myth.
Yes.
But the disturbing thing is, to me, that this could happen and we wouldn't know.
Well, Lee, we're going to end on that positive thought for today. I want to thank my guests, Lee Shearer and Gwen O'Looney. To hear this show again, visit WUGA.org for a podcast. For questions or comments, visit our Facebook page. This show does not reflect the views of the station, WXAG, or the Banner Herald. Athens News Matters is a production of WUGA, a broadcast service of the University of Georgia. I'm Alexia Ridley.